We pick up where we left off with part two of our interview. Enjoy.
And so for me, when you riff on right. these sorts of things, it's like just totally spot on.
Yeah, I mean, I can, you know, when you look at it even from an existential perspective, every human experience that we have, you know, is an opportunity to grow or to cling. And so, yeah, this happens in lucid dreaming and in our waking life. And they double back on each other. And some of the more troubling aspects of sexuality is when they do intertwine with terror, which is what we see often in some of these sleep paralysis experiences with intruders. This is something that is really difficult for people to talk about, but it's super common, especially in the lucid dreaming community, when people are already doing things like changing their sleep cycle or waking up in the middle of the night or taking galantamine and other supplements and doing things that cause shifts in our biorhythms. Sleep paralysis becomes sort of more common. Isolated sleep paralysis becomes more common. And then sometimes if you're prone to that, so to speak, it's possible that you'll have one of these, you know, entity encounters, in the classic sense of essentially being, you know, ghost raped, which is known throughout the world, of being simultaneously horrified and turned on, because it's just, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. And working with that dynamic is really challenging.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't translate into waking consciousness at all, how do you navigate that space? And it always comes back to this sense of trust, being able to take a moment, take a breath, having curiosity that kind of overcomes one's fear, you know, and creating a loop of trust within an encounter. And that's where you see these transformational shifts, you know, actually in the images of the figures who are besetting us.
Yeah.
And so, the hag becomes, you know, the beautiful figure, and the devil becomes the Adonis, and these things, you know, they really, there are gods in a sense.
Yeah.
This is the forms that they take. And so it's just by shifting our attitude and working with it, we hone that from one extreme to another. But you're right, it really is, you know, from a non-dual perspective, it's sort of the same, you're working with the same stuff here.
yeah, the energetics start to converge. So talk to us, you're obviously an expert in sleep paralysis, you literally wrote a book on it. And I have one technical question before I want you to just riff on this a little bit, because it's truly one of the more fascinating topics, both in the science of sleep and also the phenomenology of sleep. And my question is, the technical one is the relationship between sleep atonia and sleep paralysis. Are they in fact synonymous, or is sleep paralysis just a slightly inappropriate relationship to sleep atonia? Do you see them as the same thing, or do you see sleep paralysis as an inappropriate relationship to atonia? I suppose maybe define sleep paralysis to our listeners as well.
Right. So sleep paralysis is really awareness of sleep atonia, essentially, and it's awareness of being in a dream state and not being able to move. It's awareness, essentially, while the body is still asleep, awareness of consensual reality. And so it's essentially being sort of stuck in between two states of mind. And it is a Bardo state. Oh my gosh. And so as a sleep symptom, it's an extension of REM. And so in REM sleep, you know, our muscles are dampened. We don't have any muscle tone. And we experience that as paralysis. But when we're sleeping, of course, maybe this has an evolutionary capability. Who knows really how that kind of happened. But when we're dreaming, we're essentially not moving our big skeletal muscles. The diaphragm is even dampened itself. There's really not much going on except eye movements and little twitches in our fingers and whatnot. And so that paralysis extends as the mind wakes up, the frontal lobe wakes up, we realize where we are, we become lucid in the sense of, oh, I'm sleeping in my bed right now and I can feel my physical body. We try to move, can't move. And then people experience pressure on the chest or in the throat. With that comes really strong emotionality because we're still in a REM state. So we're still in a very emotional space. The amygdala is still really fired up. And so people get into some just hot flashes of, you know, death anxiety occurs, feelings of victimhood. With that sense of that there's something else in the room. And so we sort of project an autonomous other into the room with us as this is the person or the thing responsible for why I can't move and that's holding me down. And then it comes sometimes, rarely, more rarely, still common, with these hypnagogic hallucinations of actually seeing an entity that's doing this or, you know, interacting with the dreamer and drooling on the dreamer or riding the dreamer in the sexual way or just throttling the dreamer. And so there's so many traditions. There's so many different ways that this creatures have been seen. And some people see some of the same stuff, but it really, there's a lot of cultural variability. So that's really what it is this sort of strange shadow state, Bardo zone, that that exists, that is, it's mostly, it's harmless. It just happens, it tends to happen for most of us when sleep has been disrupted, our cycles are a little, have shifted some, we're jet lagged, we had too much caffeine the night before, we're hungover, we're anxious, we're super stressed, we're going through a life change, moving house, jobs, you know, and then other people who have it experience it from narcolepsy, they experience it from sleep apnea, it becomes a symptom of a larger sleep issue. Okay. And they can suffer terribly.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, but did I not read a study that some scholars, scientists, attribute alien abductions to a misinterpretation of sleep paralysis? Do you remember reading something about that?
Yeah, so that's Susan McClancy's work, and I think there's a strong argument that some alien abduction narratives are sleep paralysis experiences. Because, and this is the thing I didn't really mention, is that when you're going through these experiences, they feel really real. Yeah. You know, it's not like I'm in a dream, not even I'm in a lucid dream. I mean, it's I'm in bed and I can't move. And something that's really gross and wants to kill me is on top of me. And it's, I mean, even now when I have sleep paralysis, which is, you know, it's rarely, but I still have it occasionally. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating how scary it is. I have to work through my fear every single time. I have a protocol, but I have to work through it every single time. I can't rest on my laurels.
Totally. I'm the same way because I understand it a little bit. I find it completely fascinating. It's not to say it's still not a bit disconcerting because, you know, the sense of control is gone, but I find it, instead of freaking out, and I'm sure, just that I have to interject, I'm sure you know Shelley Adler's work with sleep paralysis and nocebo effect. I mean, when I read that, that just blew me away. Briefly for our listeners, it was this really interesting medical anthropological account of young low Asian men that were mysteriously dying in their sleep. What did she call it? Sudden unexpected nocturnal death syndrome. And she discovered that basically it was their misinterpretation of sleep paralysis and the fact that the imputed fact that they thought they were being attacked by spiritual guardians or the like because they were unable to practice their religion properly and their belief system was so powerful that unlike placebo effect which cures, nocebo effect harms and literally they scared themselves to death because of a misinterpretation which is that.
The missing pieces, and I always have to say this because people. This is a scary story, you know, that it's possible you could scare yourself to death. What happened with these Hmong refugees is these young men who were dying, it turned out that they had a heart defect, each of them, that was undiagnosed. And so there was a physical ailment that linked up with this cultural belief system that linked up with this situation where they felt unprotected. They felt like they were letting their ancestors down because they weren't their rituals. They were living in apartment buildings in Minnesota in the 1980s, and you can't sacrifice chickens in your apartment building in Minnesota. And so they weren't able to, do the ancestral work. And so the earth spirits had free reign over them.
Yeah.
And so that all that stuff worked together to create literally what, you know, I think it's still postulated, but it sounds very probable. These were men who died in their sleep and they died with a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. You know, I want to say one more thing about the proposed evolutionary aspect of sleep paralysis. You know, the running theory for our listeners is that sleep paralysis is nature's way of protecting ourselves from acting out our dreams. And when that protective kind of restraining order is lifted with things like REM behavioral sleep disorder, people do really bizarre things, which creates nightmares for litigators, like beating up sleeping partners or even driving across town and killing people or killing partners and the like. But I have a study that I want to propose. Maybe if you know people that could do this, Ryan, I'd love to see it take place. And my conjecture here is that if when the mind of, say, for instance, a meditation master has been purified, and in fact, in my deep understanding of some of the so-called mystical traditions, what happens with a complete enlightenment awakening is that there's no longer any such thing as the unconscious mind. Everything is transformed into the light of conscious awareness. And at that point, to me, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to conjecture that if that is in fact the case, there's no reason for the restraining order by nature to impose something like sleep paralysis. And therefore, they should be able to tell with meditation masters that maybe this ban has been lifted and sleep paralysis or sleep atonia is no longer in effect. And so this is something that could possibly be tested, but if you know the people that want to do it, maybe we can start a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, I really think, I mean, sleep paralysis, we talk about its negative aspects, but it also, there's a lot of people who have positive sleep paralysis experiences as well. And, you know, and I think that just as we talked about alien abduction narratives, some of them may be sleep paralysis experiences. I think this is also true with angel visitations. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a mystic from the 1800s.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, looking back at some of his vast journals, he was a master of hypnagogia. He was a master of dreaming, of lucid dreams, and clearly was experiencing sleep paralysis at times. And he, you know, would have these lengthy conversations with angels in the sleep state. On the verge, in the way he describes it as, you know, I'm in between worlds and I, you know, I mean, he's very distinct. It's like, wow, this is it. He is talking about a visitation. And so in other indigenous cultures have positive experiences as well. This is the place, this is the realm where ancestors come and depart and give information. Wow. Those who have passed on come, give information. This is, you know, the gods, the goddesses, the angels. So the creatures that are larger than life, the whole pantheon is there. That's to me, that's just blows my mind.
That's awesome. And also, again, it's this kind of alchemical thing, which I talk about in my modern terms is near enemies and near friends, is that wherever you find, like, you know, the light shadow thing, wherever there's a noble quality, there's an ignoble side. And this is, again, works. It's a two-way street. So we tend to think of sleep paralysis in mostly negative terms. But to hear these accounts of Swedenborg and others about the positive aspects of this, again, it's largely about how we relate to these experiences. And the crucible for transformation really seems to be one of understanding, really being able to appreciate what's actually taking place instead of bringing our projections and our imputations upon it. And then we see the silver lining within it. So,
and being comfortable with ambiguity, which I think is a very difficult thing. And that's to stand or to be in, and avoid like space. to notice your fears, but not let them take you off track, to stay centered and to be open to experiences in as they occur in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so let's switch gears just a teeny bit here, Ryan, if you don't mind. When you look forward with your vast lens on the lucid dreaming landscape for so many years, what is it that excites you the most, both in terms of the science and the popular understanding of where lucid dreaming is going?
That's a great question. So I'm finding myself interested in how dreams and sacred landscapes work together. And I'm interested in culturally and historically and archaeologically how other peoples use these same mind states that we have to work for them. And so I'm always delighted when I hear about some new discovery of like an ancient nap, pedestal or something that was used in an Egyptian setting or in an ancient Greek setting, and to find out that, oh, here's another example of a culture that used these capabilities for healing, right? You know, like Asclepius and that whole cult complex from ancient Greece. And so I really am interested in the wide span of not just lucid dreaming. So we've talked about how it's so expansive, it can be so many things to so many people. I'm interested in bringing it back to healing, transformation of self, understanding of the ecology that we're intermeshed in, and how can we use greater awareness to alleviate suffering in the here and now. And that comes back to honoring place, understanding spirits and landscape, and reclaiming projections with the people we meet on the street. And so using lucidity as, you know, in our dreams as practice for living as well as dying.
Beautiful. Yeah. And then what concerns you? So that's really terrific. That's what excites you. And I can totally see that. It'd be fun if we had more time to talk about things like geomancy, sacred geography, in the Tibetan worldview, this whole idea of sacred ground and the power of pilgrimage places and the like, the kind of symbiosis between inner and outer landscapes. Oh my God, we could do another podcast on that. But what concerns you when you look into the crystal ball of the future of these nocturnal practices? Where are some red flags for you?
Well, you know, I'm delighted that lucid dreaming is finally becoming a household name, you know, thanks to the work of Stephen LaBerge and a lot of the dream practitioners and their research that they did from the 1970s and onward. And then finally, you know, Christopher Nolan, you know, doing Inception, which really made the word a house, you know, people know what lucid dreaming is now. And there's, of course, misconceptions with Inception, but it got some of the core ideas out there in a way that it's like, wow, a dream is something more than that. And, you know, my only concern is that it's sort of sad how people kind of, I don't know, I guess how the industry of lucid dreaming keeps getting co-opted by the marketing colonization language that we talked about kind of in the first part of this hour.
Yeah.
And so beginners who are so thirsty and so ripe for what I would say ripe for initiation, the uninitiated dreamer comes and just essentially what happens is that they scratch the itch of lucid dreaming. And then they hit a roadblock, which is something scary, something unexpected.
Yep.
Something didn't go the right way, and then there's no cultural support for that person afterwards, and they drop it like a hot rock, and then that's it, and that was their lucid dreaming adventure. And so I'm, you know, that's why I can sort of consider my positioning as like, I don't want to be lucid dreaming 101. I want to be the person that people come to after they've kind of crashed and burned.
Yeah.
So by the work that you're doing, Andrew, is just creating this community, you're doing that work. And so I'm glad there's voices like you that are using your forms, you know, to move the work forward. But yeah, you know, it's funny, the same, you look at what's happening in the Barnes & Noble, like you look at the landscape of Barnes & Noble, you look at the bookshelf and it's like, yeah, this stuff, it's the same stuff.
Yeah.
Let's see something.
Repurpose.
I don't want something new. I want to see something old.
Yeah, that beautifully said. Something deeper. Yeah. I mean, in my personal adventure, like with you, Ryan, that's where I'm going. You know, it's like, what can we do to bring some of this ancient wisdom back into the modern light, supplant it, support it with modern scientific theory and social studies, psychological thought, and the like. And to me, when I cast my lens in that direction, and that's one reason our team got so excited about launching our little venture that we're calling Nightclub, is that from our side, we see great potentiality. And the principal reason, very much in resonance with what you just said, is when I do my gigs all over the world these days, the single most common question/complaint at the end of the program is like, well, that was cheery, but now what? Where's the support? What can we do next? And people say, is there a monastery? And I'm kind of tuned into this world, and there isn't. There's no, especially the masters, you know, the dream yoga masters, but almost by definition, they fly below the radar. They're not out there touting their wares. And so getting the support that's really necessary, especially when you start doing this deeper work, it's like you were talking about earlier, and setting. It's a little bit like an acid trip, but this time it's just an internal mind trip. Set and setting are important. And if you have the support system, even in this case, an electronic monastery, an electronic platform like we're doing and getting support with people like you, then people feel held. We can feel a little bit held in cyberspace, just like we can feel held in kind of psychic space. And so I think the more people feel that embrace, the more they can relax and feel a little bit more fearless in terms of the way they venture forward. And so if you have just another second, you're also one of these people that is really on top of the gadget business, the sleep trackers and the apps and the transcranial electrical stimulators and all that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering, both professionally and personally, where do these so-called adjunctive methods fit in your mindset? Do you use them personally? Do you advocate them? Do you have some, I know with Ursula Voss's work and the like, there are some very legitimate concerns and warnings around that. But as a general approach, how do you talk to others around those modern kind of supplements?
Yeah. So I totally have a moment. And what I would say is, whatever works. I don't really have any kind of, you know, moral compass for what are the natural ways of going lucid versus unnatural ways. I'm a believer in cognitive freedom. Mm-hmm. Notice how you're training your brain, for sure. You know, what kind of video games are you playing all day long? But video games bring on lucidity. That's kind of proven now, thanks to Jane Gackenbach's work. And so there's nothing wrong with integrating some of these newer tools into a holistic plan for going lucid, as long as I would say that that your plan is truly, truly grounded in, you've, like you said, set and setting, you know, is this a good time to go lucid in your life? And do I have the space in my home, you know, to do this, to do sleep practices and not really irritate my partner?
Yeah.
Is this a good time for me, you know, sort of psychologically, what's going on with me? Do I have someone I can talk to if I need to, if the going gets rough? And so once those sort of things are answered and basic requirements are met, I have, you know, nothing bad to say about, for instance, galantamine. You know, the work I've done with Scott Sparrow and and University of Texas, we did a double blind placebo tested regime, and galantamine works, just like Stephen LaBerge has known and talked about for years and years. And and now it's clinically validated. It induces lucid dreaming, something like a 2 to 3 times effect, maybe more, depending on the person and the, you know, the population. It can be used adjunctively. And galantamine, I think, also has some other effects as well that might be interesting. It seems to rattle our cage a little bit. We're beginning to look at these dream texts and looking at the themes. And galantamine dreams are a little more violent. They're a little more emotional. They're a little more vivid. And so they tend to bring, you know, bring up that trouble, at the same time increasing one's ability of feeling that they're safe and that they're open. So it might even be a healing adjunct that could possibly be useful for nightmares or even for PTSD nightmares. So yes, yeah, supplements can be effective. Taking a pill, you know, that you wash down with like a beer while you're watching Terminator on television isn't the best approach to going lucid, and I wouldn't advocate for it. But taking a pill is an ancient way, you know, it's taking medicine. You're taking a poison into your body. It's a ritual. And so what we know about lucid dreaming is it's a series of, you know, the induction strategies, they are rituals. Rituals are really effective to shifting consciousness.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you know, put the mugwort under your pillow, try it out, you know, you know, absolutely. And the masks, they're great if you can get them to work. And I haven't, you know, honestly, I haven't tested, there's sort of the newest wave. iWinx Aurora has a mask out. I haven't personally tested it. I certainly haven't electrocuted my brain using transcranial, and that's the one thing I would stay away from, honestly. Yeah, okay.
Let's focus on that for just a second, because as you know, Ryan, that's getting a lot of buzz these days. And Steven's a dear friend, and he has a lot of red flags on this. And we were talking about it not that long ago in the reservations about the studies and whatnot. But tell people a little bit about what that's about.
Well, if Steven's against it, that's all we really need to know, isn't it? I mean, he's a psychophysiologist. I mean, he's probably the lucid dreaming researcher who knows more about the actual electrical output of the brain than anyone. It's perhaps Ben Baird that's doing work right now. Mm-hmm. so that's a strong thing. And even Ursula Voss, whose work is being cited by some of these companies creating these masks, she says, please don't buy these products. Right. They're not meant for commercial space. We're in a laboratory. And her lucidity measures, if you look at them, I mean, measures of lucidity are going up in a statistical way, but they're not really like necessarily like jolting the lucidity forward. So, I mean, let the science continue to work in a safe laboratory setting. I have one brain. I would much rather take an ancient way of altering consciousness, i.e. a supplement, than an electrodes to my head. But that's my own personal bias.
I completely agree with you, my friend. It's like, I don't want to, you know, toast my head with some gadget like that. When you look into your crystal ball, Ryan, do you see any, I mean, outside of that one, do you see any magic bullets on the horizon? Or, I mean, one of my biggest contentions here is what sociologists refer to as single action bias. You know, it's one of the biggest problems I see with the lucid dreaming marketing thing right these days is, you know, buy my gadget, buy my mask, buy my whatever, and you'll find your way in. And I think, sure, you can have some hits and misses on that thing, but my approach is much more kind of ecologically oriented, gestalt oriented. Mm-hmm. It's kind of holistic. You know, all these, what I call the forces of the dark side, social, cultural, phenomenal, you know, an integral model, they co-conspire to bring about non-lucidity. And in my view is, again, alchemically, we can, by becoming familiar with those, by knowing thy enemy, we can transform those into friends. And to me, it's always an ecological or general kind of systems theory approach to bringing about lucidity. But with mm-hmm. that said, what do you see, if anything, on the horizon that has this kind of promise, or any promise in terms of what people in the West would call a magic bullet. Do you see that at all?
Well, I mean, I am excited about the progress that's been made with galantamine. Because Stephen LaBerge and Kristen LaMarca also had their own study.
Yeah, with Ben, right?
Yeah, with Ben Baird, right. And they had also strong positive feedback on lucid dreaming with galantamine. And this was, again, placebo. Their study was placebo controlled. And it was the best results that they had was galantamine in association with a lucid dreaming practice such as mild. I think it was mild. And that's what Scott Sparrow, we found as well, is that the best results was galantamine with something like middle of the night meditation.
Yep.
Or dream reentry. And yep. So it is taking an opportunity and focusing the mind. But so you have to do the work first. I think, I would love to see more dream ins, where you said that there's no sanctuary, temples, right?
That's right.
So,
that's right.
The idea of more dream temples, wouldn't that be something that could kind of take this all together, because we would create community, best practices, people have a charged experience, they can have an initiatory experience. I mean, that's what workshops do. When we do workshops, right, we that's create right. these experiences, and they're hypercharged. People are so, when you're so enthusiastic, your enthusiasm makes lucidity happen.
That's right.
And then go home, and so how do you take that back home with you to your own life? And that I think is always the hard part, and that is grassroots. And so the new idea is the old idea, Andrew. It's grassroots.
Yeah, no kidding. It's actually the title. I'm writing this trilogy of books, and the third one actually is entitled "The Lost Temple of Sleep: Integral Dream Yoga and the Path of Awakening." And it's exactly along the lines of what you were just saying, that like you were alluding to earlier. If you look at the ancient Greek healing temples of Asclepius, part of what brought about this incredible ability to have a dream, like lucid or not, with the divine physician, the healing god, was this temple, entire atmosphere that co-conspired to bring about the lucid dreaming state. And to me, that's really the way to go. But, in terms of like go-to methods, what you said is absolutely my go-to method. So if I 100% have to have a lucid dream in a lab, or someone asks me, what is your go-to method? It's really what you said. I do the wake and back to bed method. I set my alarm to go off 2-3 hours before I wake up. I take 8 milligrams of galantamine. I stay up, meditate for 20 minutes. I go back to sleep. I will have a lucid dream virtually every single time I do that. And so done. Share with us, what is yours? What is your go-to method? Do you have one that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I have not tried to incubate a lucid dream now for a number of years. And part of this is a personal preference, because I have young children and getting enough sleep is a problem for me. And so I just have to kind of let a lot of the experimentation go for a while. And so I've been very happy with whatever comes my way. And luckily, sleep deprivation and sleep interruption also increases lucid dreaming sometimes.
So you have a built-in.
So my go-to method is have kids.
There you go.
Have like, kids. Yeah, it's not sustainable in any way, but because eventually that you get used to the novelty. But so increasing vigilance in is always a way to going about it. But before the kids, and for instance, the work that I did in Nicaragua when I was trying to induce lucid dreams about rock art, there's this ancient pre-Columbian rock art on the island of Ometepe, and I was trying to incubate dreams about rock art so I could explore rock art in my lucid state, learn about it, see how I envisioned it, and maybe become a better field archaeologist. That's a whole nother thread we could go another time on. Mm-hmm. My method was to journal before bed my intentions. I mean, this is all classic, like Patty Garfield 1979 stuff. Yeah. Journal my intentions. I'm going to have a lucid dream tonight when I close my eyes. I'm going to, you know, stay awake. If I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm going to drift back to sleep and remember my dreams. So setting intentions specifically, but in a non-judgmental, loving way, when it doesn't happen. And then setting the alarm, waking up in the middle of the night, staying up. And then I would read, and I would either read a book about dreams, or I would go through my dream journal and try to find, you know, and just sort of look through the dreams for themes and basically just get my frontal lobe going again, drifting back to sleep with that intention in mind. And yeah, it was extraordinarily effective.
Wow. I mean, that's just awesome. Terrific. And so, I mean, oh my gosh, my dear friend, I could talk to you for hours, but just before we close, well, perhaps the last question I can toss your way, unless there's something you want to riff on, is, as you know, the single biggest issue around lucid dreaming, at least in my experience, is having the discouragement. And so when someone comes to you asking for inspiration or how to manage discouragement, what advice, how do you counsel them?
Yeah, so I mean that's a huge piece of it, and I think all of us can relate to that, being discouraged. I tell people to take a break, and wait to the natural desire to go lucid comes up again. And what I teach in my ebook, which is the Lucid Immersion Guidebook, and it's on Amazon. It's also on dreamstudies.com, which is where my own self-published ebooks are sold. Mm-hmm. What I basically teach is a method that clusters practices, you know, so you're trying to do several lucid practices at a time, but for only a short period of time. Say, I'm going to do these practices for the next 5 days because I'm looking at my calendar and it's looking pretty clear. Mm-hmm. My roommates are out of town and, I'm going to be able to sleep in, and I'm going to be able to get that extra REM, whatever kind of, so sort of set a time period of, I'm going to immerse myself in lucid dreaming for a day, 2 days, or 5 days. Set the practices, do the practices, do the work, journal the whole thing, what worked and what didn't, journal the non-lucid dreams, mm-hmm. and then let it go. Take time off.
Yep.
Because we're just not wired to just pick up these weird little lucid dreaming induction strategies and keep doing them. And besides, the mind just gets used to them anyway. And yeah. So part of lucid dreaming is about creating positive stress or vigilance, mm-hmm. And mixing that up with novelty. And that's hard to do when we are kind of like living the same day every day. So, yeah. So basically you create these Asclepian moments.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And then let it go. And sometimes it's odd, but you'll get an odd lucid dream when you've let it go, because that's just the way.
It's when you open and relax. I mean, it's part of what Stephen LaBerge does, as you know, Ryan, with his programs when he does them at Hawaii. And I've attended and co-taught some of those with him. These programs are incredibly spacious, and that's by design, because this kind of openness is integral to opening to these. We call them altered states of consciousness, but I would say that what we perceive as normal consciousness, that's what's altered. Lucid dreams are more than natural bandwidth. But I think that's really important for people, because especially in the West, we have a tendency to try too hard, to overachieve, to expect instant results. And what I say is, it's taken a long time for us to get so non-lucid. We're really essentially practicing non-lucidity all the time. Every time we succumb to mindlessness, distraction, or forgetfulness, those are just synonyms for non-lucidity. And so it's no wonder that we're virtuosos in the perverse art of non-lucidity, because we practice it all the time. And so understand that, be patient, be open, realize it takes a little while to stop the Titanic as it's running full steam across the Atlantic, and just give yourself a little bit of breathing room. So,
yeah,
in conclusion here, my friend, share with us what you're working on now, and then finally, how people can learn more about you. So what is your current project? You mentioned something about the work with sacred geography and the like, which I, oh my gosh, I'd love to talk to you further about that in the future session.
Oh gosh, so briefly, I sometimes consult with a nonprofit organization called the Worldwide Indigenous Science Network, which works by networking together healers and shamans from around the world in helping them share their knowledge bases in the hopes that Western people also begin to explore, you know, our own essential selves that are underneath the colonial mindset, that we all have ways of being that are natural. They do really wonderful work. And so I do some dream work with them. I'll be going to France later this year to do some dream work with them in a sacred setting. We'll actually be at Chartres Cathedral.
Oh, wow.
Working some dreams, which, besides being an amazing cathedral, was long ago it's built on a spring. And it probably, you know, it was a pagan altar site before it was a church. So talk about sacred geography, you know.
Wow.
So I'm really excited about that. And I have a number of websites, you know, and one of the projects that I'm excited about that we haven't talked about is my talisman project, because I partnered with a friend of mine who makes coins for a living. And we've made our own Lucid talisman, and we sell that on lucidtalisman.com. And it basically is a reality check tool. And it's got a bunch of esoteric Easter eggs. It's very, I think you would dig it, because we've been talking about alchemy a lot, permeated throughout this call. And it uses a lot of the alchemical languages and images. And the idea is that the talisman used, you know, repetitively as a reality check, can anchor itself and then become a cognitive habit, and then it shows up in your dreams. And it also can be used as a mindfulness tool or a fidget tool, or for people who suffer from anxiety, you know, a way to be a grounding tool. And so it has a lot of just solid ways of sort of increasing mindfulness. And we donate some money every year to nightmare research. So last year we donated to the International Association for the Study of Dreams for their student research funds. So that will go towards funding further research into dreams and nightmares. So that's one thing that I've been working with that I've been very excited about. And I'm working on some new stuff with lucid dreaming that I can't really talk about it much yet, but I will say it's interesting because the theme is gamification.
Oh, cool. Well,
and I'm just working on with some way. I thought this project was going to be a book. Maybe it will still, but I've been sitting with it for quite some time. And recently it kind of came to me. I woke up with the idea, oddly enough, and I was like, no, this wants to be somehow a game.
Oh, cool.
And so I've been playing with it, and that's been really fun. So anyhow, you know, you mentioned my blog, which, you know, I have not been very active there recently, but it's been active since 2007. So there's so many articles there.
Cool.
And dreamstudies.com is where my ebooks are.
Yeah. Wow. Any final thoughts, General? I mean, we've covered so much really provocative terrain in the last hour and a half or so, but any final thoughts you want to share with us before we sign off?
Well, just that, you know, that I really think it's such a wonderful pursuit of the pursuit of lucidity, that to just, I think, to remember to be patient and to let it come as it wants to come, because dreams, you know, lucid dreams are dreams, and dreams are mercurial, and they have their own processes going on that we don't really quite understand until decades later, looking back at our journals. Mm-hmm. And just be super patient with your process, and as it unfolds, because it's unique and it's your own.
Yeah. Well said, my friend. Well, Ryan, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with us a little bit. It's always a delight for me. The most rewarding aspect of what we're doing is actually hanging out with people like you and introducing our audience to your work and this kind of cross-pollinating theme that is a charter of what we're trying to do here. So deep bow of gratitude. I look forward to future contacts with you. I look forward to your future work. And let's do this again someday.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. This has been a wonderful end of my day.
Terrific. Okay, my friend. We'll talk to you later.